Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From Lower Manhattan, the center of the financial world, this is Money Talking from WNYC. Good morning, I'm Charlie Herman. I'm joined today by our regular contributors, Rana Faruhar of Time Magazine, and Joe Nocera with the New York Times, who's actually in Aspen at the Ideas Festival, but we'll get to that in a minute. First, the long wait is over. The Supreme Court has ruled, the healthcare law stands. And as the analysis of the decision continues, it's good to remember that one of the original goals of this law was to keep healthcare costs from soaring. And right now, those costs are rising at about double the rate of inflation. So with this decision, where the law stands now, Joe, will it rein in healthcare costs?
Well, the sad truth is probably not. The first thing you have to understand is that what this law really is health insurance reform, not health care or health care cost reform. You know, its primary goal was to ensure that every American gets health care, whether they're employed or unemployed or what their status is. There are pockets of money here and there in the law that allow people to do experiments that attempt to bring down the cost. For instance, electronic records, is going to be some money to hopefully encourage healthcare companies to do more of that instead of the old-fashioned way by hand, which incredibly we still do. You know, insurance companies themselves are saying that premiums are going to go up, that there are built-in costs because they're going to be insuring everybody. So the real question is not whether they will cut the cost, but will they at least be able to slow the rise of healthcare costs, which, given the way they've risen, would in itself be a triumph.
So, Rana, if one of the reasons why healthcare costs are so expensive is because of this inefficiency, because of these higher administrative costs, there's actually been some studies that have found they can cost anywhere from, say, 18 to 30% of healthcare spending. Is this law addressing the right problems?
Well, you know, I would say no. I think ultimately, in my dream world, we would have been on a single-payer system. Now, that wasn't going to happen politically, of course, but that's where you see real efficiencies. When you have one healthcare system across the country, you've got a one-stop system. You know, Joe was mentioning about electronic records earlier. You can just look at what happens in the UK. They've got an entire computerized system for national healthcare records. You enter information one time. Anyone can access it anywhere in any part of the country. You start to see real savings when you have that kind of cohesiveness. That's not what we're getting here, but I think given the political situation in the U.S., this is a good step in the right direction.
Well, where we're at right now is that the mandate lives. There's this requirement that everyone is going to have health care by 2014, and if not, they're going to have to pay a penalty. So from a pure, like, pocketbook issue, you know, what is this going to mean for us? Are we going to be paying more or less in the future?
Well, I think that what we're going to see is a bending of the healthcare curve. Optimists believe that the growth in healthcare spending will actually slow, and that's not nothing. I think that we're going to see less spent on emergency room visits. I think we're going to see more spent on primary care rather than expensive specialists. That's all really good. Now, who saves is going to depend on who you are. Individuals, small business, people within big companies, all of this is variable. I don't think we're going to see an absolute decrease in costs.
Well, the Supreme Court decision isn't the only news Wall Street's watching. This week also brought headlines about two of the most famous CEOs. Larry Page, one of the founders of Google, skipped his company's developer conference this week, citing a throat condition, and Rupert Murdoch is splitting his beloved company News Corp in two. So, Rana, Larry Page gets a sore throat and investors start freaking out. The shares of Google have been all over the place. What's going on?
Well, I think that Google is in a very interesting place with their own development. I was very surprised, actually, when they brought Larry Page back, because I see Google as a very large international company that still behaves in some way like a small company, and that's one of its major problems. I mean, there's a lot of people in a lot of meetings. You have to get buy-in from the top folks. There's not as much of a kind of a cohesive management structure as you would see in a firm that big. So, you know, I don't want to speculate on Larry's healthcare problems, but I do think that it's interesting that he was the one that was brought back, and I'm not sure that that's strategically the right decision right now.
Joe, is part of the problem when you look at Murdoch or at Page is that we're still sort of obsessed with celebrity CEOs? I mean, if we're investing too much in them, could this be a turning point that maybe we're moving away from this adoration of the celebrity CEO?
I would hope so. It's long overdue. I mean, there are numerous studies that show that celebrity CEOs don't perform any better and quite often worse than others. In the case of Rupert Murdoch, I mean, here's a guy who single-handedly built a significant media company, but he's ruled over it like it's his fiefdom. And his professional managers have wanted to shed its newspaper divisions for a very long time, and he's resisted, and there's nothing anybody could do about it because he's Rupert Murdoch. Now you have this scandal, and the scandal kind of shows what the downside of having, the CEO as king.
You're talking about the scandal in Britain.
Yes, the phone hacking scandal in Britain. And so as a result of that, he has been cut down to size quite a bit. And what's happening here is that professional management inside his company is forcing him to do something that he has never wanted to do, but probably they need to do for the company to go forward.
Well, finally, let's take a look ahead at some of the news that's coming up. With me again are Rana Faruhar of Time Magazine and Joe Nocera from the New York Times. Joe, you're at the Aspen Ideas Festival, a sort of thinking man's Lollapalooza. What are people looking ahead to there?
They're thinking a lot about the state of the economy. Alan Krueger, one of President Obama's top economic advisors, is talking about middle-class jobs. Simon Johnson, the MIT professor, who is a former IMF economist, is talking about the euro crisis. Howard Schultz from Starbucks is here talking about whether shareholder value is still the most important value. And I might add, there's a lot of talk about Steve Jobs, and perhaps it's only a coincidence that the president of the Aspen Institute, which runs this festival, is Walter Isaacson, who is his biographer.
Rana, what are you looking ahead to?
Well, I've just started reading a book by a longtime source of mine, Frank Partnoy, who's a former derivatives trader, now a law professor at the University of San Diego. And he's just written a book called Wait, which is about the science of delay. And his main thesis is that all kinds of decision-making actually benefit from delay. So it's kind of the opposite of Malcolm Gladwell's blink. You know, not that you should make decisions on a gut basis very quickly, but that you should figure out how long you have to make a decision, and then you should wait till the 11th hour. And there's a lot to be said for this in financial decision-making. I think we're going to see it talked about in regulatory circles.
Procrastinators of the world, unite. Well, we'll be watching those stories and all the week's financial news at WNYC.org/business. You can take this program with you as a podcast, available on iTunes. I'm Charlie Herman. This is Money Talking from WNYC.